It was traced to the relay circuits. That when those relay circuits and that automatic antenna tuner fail, the radio will not perform. Over.
Yeah, I think there's a number of things to investigate here. From what Jeff is telling us, he runs the 7800 for 100 watt output when the amplifier is in the bypass mode. He then puts the amplifier in the active mode, tries adjusting the ALC, and he gets exactly 100 watts output. Overly coincidental. If he really had a driver failure or an amplifier failure, and if he told me he's getting 41 watts output maximum, or he's getting 321 watts output, I would accept it. The fact that when the amplifier is supposedly active, giving him the exact same power output as his exciter, which means the amplifier is running a gain at 0.0 dB, overly coincidental. Something else is going on here. Glenn, KC2QIQ, go right ahead.
Back to me, Dick. No. Got a misunderstanding.
All right, go ahead there, Mel.
Okay, the test is, with the ICOM 7800 running independent, is it putting out 100 watts? Number one. Then, if it's connected to the amplifier, is it putting out less than 100 watts? That, I want to know the question. Because if that's the case, in other words, independent, the transceiver is putting out 100 watts. With the ICPW1 connected in the power-off position, it puts out less than 100 watts. The problem is that internal tuning, automatic tuning, is defective, Dick. Over.
Okay, let's go back to Jeff for a repeat now. You've seen 100 watts coming out of your 7800. I presume the amplifier was in the bypass mode. You put the amplifier in the active mode, where it should be giving you a gallon of output, so to speak, some real gain. And then I think you said when you adjust the ALC circuit, you can get up to 100, and then it trips out. And Mel is also asking, before you did that readjustment of the ALC tiny screwdriver thing, what was your 7800 100 watts, what was it giving as the output of the amplifier? Over to you for any further information on that one, Jeff. K2MIT, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, if you'd like, I'm upstairs and I can go downstairs. If you want to talk about a few things, I can give you the answers live. If we want to play these games, I'm very happy to do them. I don't know if it's outside the purview of this session. You let me know.
Okay. I may have made it sound a little bit too exacting there, Jeff. We're asking for your recollection. Up until 2 days ago, you were getting a gallon. All of a sudden, the very first indication you had is a lot less than a gallon. What was the first indication you had during the so-called failure, or the misbehaving of the rig? What was the power output in the active mode before you did anything? Give us your recollection on that one, Jeff. K2MIT, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, this afternoon I was speaking to him, and I had 800, 900 watts. I wasn't fully driving it. The radio, the transceiver is a 200 watt radio, and I can get 100 if it's 200, and I can get full output with the amplifier in bypass mode. Looking at an external watt meter, going into a dummy load, going into just looking at the power output of the rig. I hope that answers your Mel's question.
Yeah, but now try my question. Under normal circumstances, you're setting your 7800 something close to 100 watts of output. And on a good day, your ICPW1 will give you something close to a kilowatt of output. And that was hunky-dory up until a day or so ago. All of a sudden, you got less power output. What was the first indication you had of the power output of the amplifier, the ICPW1, before you did any readjusting? Did it jump from 900 watts down to 80 watts? That's what I'm looking for. What was the new failure mode of power output? Over to you, Jeff, K2RIW in the TechNet.
So, I also think I can, I drive it with 30 watts output or 40 watts output and give 100 watts. So maybe there's a preamplifier in the circuitry. I don't know, but it was producing 100 watts, and then it went to, when I pushed the amplifier on button, it went to 800-900. What happened was the protection circuitry, the amp circuit normally is green, and it went red, and there's a little auto button which normally says green, and it went flashing green. I got to look at the manual to figure out what that is, and then all I ever got was whatever I put into it, if you know what I mean.
Okay, so when the amplifier today in the failure mode is being used, if you drive it with 50, you get 50. If you drive it with 100, you get 100. If you go beyond that, it trips out. In other words, it appears to be acting at 0 decibels of gain, so to speak. Over to you, Jeff.
Yeah, it trips out about 115, 120. It has 0 dB of gain into any dummy load, any antenna. My antenna made it through the windstorm okay. I'm able to use it with just the radio. I've tried another radio with it. You know, the SWR is fine, multiple bands, so thank God. That answers your question. K2MIT for ID.
I have another time on K2K1.
Yeah, we also got to go over to Glenn, because I'm overly curious about the near unity in power input versus power output. Overly coincidental. I'm a little bit worried about when you think the amplifier today is in the active mode, it may be in the passive mode, in the bypass mode. The fact that your drive power and output power are essentially equal. For an amplifier that normally has 10 decibels of gain to all of a sudden have 0 decibels of gain as opposed to minus 10, I mean, a failed amplifier will go from plus 10 dB of gain to minus 10 dB of gain. I'd accept that. For it to jump down to exactly zero, my goodness, is that a coincidence? Not impossible, but a bit rare, and I'm worried that it might really be, you think it's active, but it's in the bypass mode for some crazy reason. Let's see if Mel's got some suggestions on this. K2KEY, and then we're going to go over to Glenn. K2RW, you got it, Mel.
Exactly. You hit it on the nail on the head, Dick. That amplifier is never supposed to be pushed past the 100 watts. The 100 watt level is the 100% output on that. In fact, you use a lot, you can run it with a lot less and get the full kilowatt out of it. So when you drive it, you, in under normal circumstances, if you put more than 100 watts into the ICPW1, it can go into shutdown. It'll go into that that sort of thing. It's up to test, basically. You're not supposed to drive it past the 100-watt input level. The IC, the 7800 transceiver is capable of 200, but you're never supposed to run it at full power of the 200-watt level into the ICPW1 at any time, Dick, over.
He's telling you it's in the protection.
Yeah, I'm getting the impression that it could very well be in the protect mode. Let's see what Glenn's got to say with all this. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, it's been good that I've been listening in the background to you, because now I've got a much better picture of what's actually going on with this amp. That amp's actually got a controller inside of it, and it measures a few things. Input power, controls the ALC signal going back, and also looks at the current in the, going to the modules, and it takes measurements of it. If any transistor gets a short inside of it, whether it's the driver or any of the output modules, basically it gets an overcurrent signal and will no longer allow the TR switch to switch over. So apparently it sounds like this amplifier is wounded. It's got some probably bleeding silicon inside of it, and it's got a short circuit someplace. And rather than just short out the power supply, what it's basically doing is sending the controller a signal, and it's just stuck in the bypass mode right now. So basically whatever goes in goes out, whether it's in transmit or not. But unfortunately, I hate to say it, it just sounds like this poor amplifier needs some silicon replacement and possibly something else. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, we got a lot of brain power on frequency right now, Jeff, addressing your amplifier. And a fair number of these people have got experience with your exact setup. That's very helpful. It sounds to me like the microprocessor controller in there has got enough brain power to know that if there's an overdrive, if there's an overcurrent, if there's an overvoltage, if there's any one of the failure mechanisms, it goes into a self-protect bypass mode. Of all the people who are present, please give me your call letters right now and tell me what is the main indication on the front panel, flashing green light, flashing red light, whatever. What is the indication on the front panel that will, with no ambiguity, tell Jeffrey that the amplifier is in the bypass mode? Therefore, his drive power is his output power. That's what I'm hearing. But how can he confirm that? Who knows what the amplifier will be indicating on the front panel telling all of us it's in the bypass mode? Give me your call letters right now. K2RYW and TechNet.
I can answer that.
Go right ahead. I can answer that. Sounds like TTT.
No, it's Jeffrey, K2MIT. There's a button under the tuner that says amp slash protect. Normally it's green, turns to red, your host.
Okay. Tell me what indications you have seen, Jeff. When you're using the amplifier in what you think is the active mode, what indications does it give you, and what does the manual tell you is the interpretation of those indications? You got it, Jeff.
Green is good, red, not good. I'm downloading the manual now. I rummaged through all my manuals. I couldn't find it, so let other people answer your question, but that's the answer that I have. I'm going to download it right now.
Okay, you're telling me what the manual says. Now tell me what Jeffrey saw. During the time that you first saw the failure and you tried to put the amplifier in the active afterburner mode, what indication did you see on the front panel? You said it before and I wasn't smart enough to listen to you. I think you told me you saw a flashing green light or something like that. What indication did it first give you at the beginning of the failure from your memory? Go ahead, Jeffrey.
Oh, it went from flashing green to, or it went from on green to flashing red or just regular red. I can't remember, but green went to red.
Okay, that's a pretty strong indication that the amplifier told you that its microprocessor detected an error, and therefore it sounds like it went into the bypass or protect mode. Does anyone on frequency have a different opinion on that one? K2RYW, give me your call letters right now.
K2KEY.
Mel Ricker, guys, and anyone else? You got it, Mel.
Okay, when it's in the red, I remember correctly, now, I haven't used that rig in about a year and a half now. Basically, yeah, it was a year and a half since I've had that radio, using it here for a period of time, the whole setup. And I remember that I really looked into it a little bit because I was pretty fascinated by this amplifier. And the protect mode or the microprocessor in there is really thorough. If you exceed a number of different factors, like if the drive signal is exceeded, it will go into a protect mode and a red light will come on. If your SWR exceeds a point where the tuner, the automatic tuner, couldn't handle it, it is going to. In other words, it prevents any kind of supposedly damage to the transistors, the output transistor, and the power supply. It will shut it down. That's basically what it is. It's putting it into protect mode for a number of reasons. One of the prominent reasons, like I say, they've had with that, the issue they had, is with the automatic tuner not functioning correctly, which puts it immediately into that that condition. Because some of the people said that when they went from one antenna to another, if the response wasn't quick enough, in other words, they made a mistake and just switched antennas, you know, while talking, you know, doing an A-B test and forgetting to pause while you flip the switch over, they said that the tendency was for it to go into a protect mode because the transient time was too short, over.
makes a lot of sense. And yes, anybody switching antennas knows that no matter what kind of a switch you use, no matter what kind of a relay you use, most likely you have a break before make. Therefore, there's going to be some number of milliseconds or seconds of open circuit. And a solid-state kilowatt amplifier looking at an open circuit is not good. You don't want to dwell there very long, and therefore the microprocessor in that situation most likely detects an error and goes into a self-protect mode. Okay, with all the brain power we've got on this frequency at this time, addressing Jeff's problem, I'm going to put words in Jeffrey's mouth. If I was Jeffrey, I would now say, okay, you guys, what do you recommend I do to go to do the next step of troubleshooting in order to confirm that there is irreparable error? In other words, it's not just pilot error where the controls are set the wrong way. Does anyone have a suggestion for Jeff as to what he should do next to confirm that the amplifier is continuously in the bypass protect mode, that it refuses to go into the active amplification mode, so that he's got a complete confirmation of an error that requires repair and or return to the factory, so to speak? Anyone's got any suggestions along those lines as to what Jeff should take for the next step? Please give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2QIQ.
Glenn recognized. Anyone else?
Yeah, K2KEY. I can give him a quick suggestion.
Okay, we got at least two good suggestions. Here we go. Glenn, first, you got it.
Sure. I think these tests he had already run, but we'll run through them again one more time. In a situation like this, you want to take the output of the transceiver with the amplifier combination, inspect all the cables, make sure the cables are all good, make sure all the interconnection cables for ALC and the TR are all connected properly, make sure all the grounds are good, the power supply connections are good, everything's all connected properly. Then take a known good cable from the output of the amplifier and put it into a dummy load. Then try the tune-up procedure. If the amplifier is stuck in the failed condition, it's a pretty good indication that you still have a problem with the amplifier. But following that, I believe you had mentioned from what you had said before that you did do that, but if not, maybe just double check it again, double check the cables, put it into a dummy load, and try the tune-up procedure. If it doesn't, unfortunately, I think something needs to be repaired. At least at minimum, you'd have to go into the amplifier or send it back for repair. K2RIW, KC2QIQ, I guess pass it over to Mel.
Buy a service manual. He's already got the service manual that's being downloaded to him as we speak. Mel, K2KEY, go ahead, Mel.
Okay, here's the procedure. You're going to put the amplifier on. You'll see the green light will come on. If the red light comes on, without any drive, just push the button, and it comes on the red light instantly, you've got a problem in the power supply in there. If the green light comes on, now you apply drive, turn down the RF power output on the 7800. Turn that control on the bottom there to the left. That's all the power output all the way down. You're going to bring that up very slow. Now, you're going to observe the meter. You're going to see if there's any RF output as you're bringing it up. If it then trips after you go up, say, a certain amount of watts, let's say you go up 30, 40, 50 watts, and it trips at that point, then I know your problem is strictly in the output circuit. One of two things. It's either the automatic antenna tuner circuit is malfunctioning, and usually you can tell that because I think you can hear it hunting a little bit. If I remember, I heard it. I can hear the relays, the assembly there hunting when when you first initiate it up on a, like you change band, you hear that initiation side. If you don't hear that, the automatic antenna tuning system, I would assume, is not working. However, if that is, if either that or one of the output modules has got a, like Glenn said, maybe a bare silicon something, another on that module, Dick, over.
Very logical sounding tune-up procedure. Glenn, do you have a further comment on this? KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
No, Dick, unfortunately I don't at this point. I think it's really up to MIT at this point whether he wants to decide
decide if he wants to go inside or not, then we can open up a whole other group of suggestions. K2RAW, K22QIQ.
If this was a tube-type amplifier, where most of us have got reasonable good instrumentation, voltmeters and ammeters and whatever, and there's simple tests you can do by putting a pencil nearby and drawing an arc and whatever, there's a bunch of things you can do with a tube amplifier. With a modern-day solid-state amplifier, to open up the front cover, open up the top cover, and start digging inside, I'd go a little slow on that one. My guess is the manufacturer is going a little bit slow. You're probably going to be breaking some seals, maybe breaking some, voiding some warranties and so on. So troubleshooting a kilowatt type power supply and amplifier, not easy, unless you've got quite a bit of experience. I know that Mel's hand and Glenn's hand would shake a little bit if he started doing that. He'd go very slowly to be sure he's not creating an inadvertent short circuit with a screwdriver, so to speak, and creating some further damage. Anyone, any further suggestions for Jeffrey before we turn it back to Jeffrey? Give me a call. It is right now. K2RAW in the TechNet.
W2TTT.
Go right ahead, Gordon.
After he does all the things that we've talked about here, I really think it would be a good idea to go look at one of either the ICOM list or the 7700 list, one of the other ones that Adam Farson administers on Yahoo Groups. He'll be very, very happy with what you find from him. He's really resourceful and can point you around. Also, some of those Yahoo Groups have a lot of information that might be useful because a lot of these topics have come up before, so reading might hurt, not hurt, but Adam is like a walking index of everything that's walked through these lists. He's amazing. So I would encourage you to shoot him a personal email. It's AB40J is his call. He's also got a VE7 call, but VE7, VE6, I can't remember. Anyway, bottom line is that he lives in Canada, actually, but you'll be well to do that. W2TTT.
Thank you, Gordon. Sounds like some darn good information. Okay, Jeffrey, you've got quite a few of us on the edge of our chair, excited to help you. We've only been limited help, we know that. But we'd like you to come back and tell us what you discovered, what you decided to do next, and keep us informed as to this one, because it's an extremely well-respected, fine piece of equipment. Unfortunately, yours has got some hiccups right now, but I'll bet you it's quite fixable. K2MIT for any other comments. K2RAW in the TechNet.
Thanks, guys. I do appreciate it. I've tried to make steps, and most likely going back to ICOM. I do appreciate it, and I'll keep you guys informed. K2MIT is clear. Thanks, everybody.
One last question I've got for you, Jeff. The ICPW-1, you hope that roughly... signed in earlier with the questions because we're
here.
Okay, yep.
EWK Eugene.
Go ahead, Eugene. W2EWK.
Okay, Dick. I realize Christmas has passed by, but I do have a gift for you. The gift is I have a book, and the book is from RCA, and my father had the book, and I don't want the book anymore. My father passed on, and the book is like a foot thick. It explains all about the tube, RCA tubes and stuff like that. Do you want that particular book, yes or no?
It's an awful nice offer, Eugene. I might have to turn you down. I have been collecting books, tubes, transmitters, solid-state equipment, test equipment. I've been collecting stuff for 40 solid years. And now when somebody offers me something very valuable, I have to think twice. I'm running out of room in my house. My bookshelves are full. My equipment shelves are full and so on, so I got to go slow. I don't use tubes very much anymore. In fact, other than the 4CX250B tube and microwave traveling wave tubes, I use no tubes anymore. So what you've made is a fine offer, and there are people out there who will appreciate it. But I think I've got to turn you down. I'm running out of room, and I got to be careful. Sorry about that, Eugene. W2EWK, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Dick, the price is right. It's called Freddy, F-R-E-E. Okay, if you don't want it, if anyone else wants it, you know, just give me a call. It's yours. The book is old. Guy, is the book old? Super, super old. You know, I guess it goes back to 1940s and stuff like that, you know. Very, very, very old. So if you find some room there, Dick, give me another shout, W2EWK.
W2TTT.
There's a man who might be interested. Go ahead, Glenn. I mean, Gordon.
Yeah, just one suggestion. There's a couple of AmFests coming up, and, you know, I'll bet you that they would love to have it as a door prize if you're willing to give it away. I know I'm running a AmFest for our venture crew and Boy Scout troop next week in Bergenfield, New Jersey, about 10 minutes from the George Washington Bridge. If anyone wants information about it, it's a Saturday AmFest. Includes a ticket for a pancake breakfast when you come. So AmFest or not, you're going to get fed. So it's just another thought, but W2TTT@AdaWorld.net. You can email me there. We can find a way to get the book from you. Maybe someone can bring it if they're coming from the island. But just one thought, and that, of course, if anyone wants to come to the HamFest, we'd love to have you. It's a lot closer than Oakark. Just a thought, W2TTT.
Okay.
I'll tell you what. The first person that comes to my home, QTH, gets the book, and they can do whatever they want to do with the book, donate to the radio club or wherever. I'll give out my phone number. It's area code 631-475-1907. USL?
475-19-7. What was the missing digit?
1987.
That's a good year. Now, there are a couple of guys on this repeater who are real vintage radio enthusiasts. N2EO, Rich is one of them. Hal is another one. There's two or three guys that really love vintage radios, and they collect them and pay good money for them, refurbish them, and so on. And so the tubes that go into the vintage radio, the vintage tubes, oh, this one foot thick book back in the 40s from the RCA company that Eugene is offering. The price is right. We got to make sure we pass this offer to both Hal and Rich, among others, among the real vintage radio enthusiasts. So I think a vintage radio enthusiast might get a little bit more appreciation than a person who appears at a HamFest. But that's just an opinion. I'm not sure. So make sure that anyone within the sound of Eugene and my voice tells Rich and Hal that this vintage tube manual is available. And with any further questions or comments, give me a call. Let us K2RIW.
Yeah, I'm here, Dick, M2EO. I'm going to turn that nice offer down because I've got plenty of vintage books here. But I do have a quick question to the net, Dick, M2EO.
Okay. One quick question. I'm going to pass it back to you for your question. Also, do you think Hal might be interested in this? You know the guys who are vintage radio enthusiasts. What do you think? Is there a vintage radio enthusiast that you think should be informed about this offer? N2EO, K2LIW.
I really don't know, Dick. You might contact Hal DPZ. He might be interested in it, but can't think of anybody offhand, Dick. I've got a number of books on two books, textbooks from when I was at RCA Institute. I have a number of reprints of the RCA tube manual from the 60s, so I'm pretty well set up here. Dick, I have a question. I don't know if it was a joke or what, but I was looking at something on CNN about a month ago. The volume was turned down because it was inside of Dunkin' Donuts, where they have, they run CNN there, and they have the volume down. Maybe Paul, because it has to do with space reports. But they showed a photograph, and it said that trapped under the ice, I don't know where, on some planet or somewhere, and I don't know if it was the Mars rover or something, they showed a picture of all things, a fish, and it said this had been discovered on another planet or somewhere. I have no idea what it was. Maybe it was a joke on CNN. It was not April 1st, by the way. So, I don't know. I haven't heard any more about it. I would have thought it would have made big news.
Yeah, a fish on a foreign planet, on another planet or a moon, that would be one hell of a discovery. And how would you get a photograph of that? Now, the most recent things that I've been hearing are, number one, the National Traffic Highway Safety Administration has directly employed NASA to do further investigation of the microprocessors in Toyota automobiles, because NASA has a strong responsibility of making extremely reliable computers that go on their spacecraft, that are going to go for years and years out into space with heavy exposure of ultraviolet and cosmic rays and everything else. So the methods that they have come up with to make extremely high reliability computers, they want to look at the failure mechanisms they know about and find out whether or not Toyota can do it. And another parallel report to that was that someone said that the microprocessors in a modern automobile are getting complicated enough that there is the possibility of what's called a single event upset. Let me drop. A number of the spacecraft, particularly the ones in synchronous orbit, geosynchronous orbit, have in past years run into what's called a single event upset. A blast of material comes out of the sun, or a blast of cosmic rays comes somewhere else in space, hits the geosynchronous satellite, and does damage to its solar cells and power supply. Now, that event has happened a couple of times, and although we're below the atmosphere and heavily shielded from that, we're not thoroughly immune from it. And so, as computers become more and more elaborate and extensive, they become a little bit more vulnerable to that if specific design techniques have not been deployed to get around that. Another NASA announcement has been that they're finding more and more water on the North Pole of Mars in various craters, and they're slowly discovering the total amount of water in various forms. I said Mars, I meant Moon. The total amount of water that they're finding at the North Pole of the Moon is now beyond the point where you could be processing it, making rocket fuel out of it, and after you land on the Moon, you'd be generating the fuel that you need in order to get back home, so to speak. So that's one of the things that's been discovered. I think we should go over now to Paul, WS2N.
And Y2H.
And KC2QIQ with a comment.
Okay. So before we go over to Paul, let's go over to Glenn. And Paul's going to be giving us a space report. But go ahead, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, oddly enough, Dick, about a couple of weeks ago, there was something on the news about an arthropod, a very, very deep-sea fish. It's not seen very, very often, and one of the largest ones ever seen. I think the thing is over a foot in length, and it's a really pretty alien-looking creature. And I think this might be what Rich was talking about. It was discovered, I'm not sure if it was discovered in ice. I think they packed it in ice to bring it back, but it was actually discovered. Which normally these things are very, very rarely seen, and it's quite an alien-looking type of a thing. It looks like a mixture of like a horseshoe crab and a lobster and a few other things all mixed together. A pretty ugly-looking creature. But I think it was being described as something that looked like it was from outer space, but actually that was actually on the news about 2 weeks ago or so. Might be what Richard was seeing on TV with the volume down. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
WS Glenn.
Yeah, I'm going to go over to Paul in a second. Glenn, what was the location on planet Earth where that discovery was made, if you remember?
You know, Dick, I don't remember. It was something I saw that came up on the news, and I was just reading through it very, very briefly, and I was unfortunately more interested in pictures and what an ugly-looking thing this thing was and how large it was. And I can imagine, boy, that's something that if you knew it was in the bay where you were swimming, boy, you'd never go anywhere. K2RXW, KC2, QIQ.
Dick, that's not what Rich is talking about, though. Okay. Wait for a full recycle and watch your watch, Paul. Look at your watch or your clock or whatever, and every minute or so give an interrupt. WS2N with our space report. K2RIW, you got it, Paul.
Yeah, it's a habit after all these years, pushing the key right after the tone. It's hard to do that, Dick. But we'll try. What Anthony here was talking about, Rich, NASA, I think it was middle of May, they lowered a camera 600 feet below the ice in Antarctica and expected to really find nothing. Maybe they will, you know, maybe microbes or something if they were lucky. But these were like shrimp-like creatures that came right up to the camera and attached themselves to the cable, and that's what they were surprised about. They expected really pretty much nothing to be there at that depth where they were looking. And the whole investigation comes from, in the future, they plan on sending a spacecraft to Europa, a moon surrounded with ice and water, you know, in the Jupiter system. Let me drop. And eventually the idea is to say this moon is covered maybe a mile thick of ice or more, and they want to melt the hull directly to the bottom of the ice and send the craft in and have it photograph everything that's down there and try to find life, you know, floating around in this ocean world. So, you know, they run experiments all the time and looking for life where you might not think it might show up. Sure enough, they found these they're actually on a large size, shark-like creatures, and there's a couple of different species down there too as well. So that's probably what was on CNN. I do remember that roughly in the middle of May. WS2N, I'll give you a space report if you like.
A space report, I would like. Go right ahead there, Paul.
Okay, fine business. We have a space shuttle going up tomorrow at 6:21 in the morning, Eastern Standard Time. STS-131, Discovery. There's only four missions left. After this one, there'll be three missions left. You got one like in May, and then another one I think in July or something. And then the final mission is middle of September. I think it was the 15th of September. And that will be the last of all for any space shuttle missions forever. So that's the present schedule. This one is a restocking mission, big ammonia tanks, big things that they need for the space station, that big things that they might need in the future, that the shuttle is the only thing capable of bringing it up. Also, they have the Leonardo module inside the cargo thing. What they do with that, there's a bunch of science racks on that. And they attach it to one of the nodes and open a door. You know, you go floating around inside this thing. It becomes an additional room to the space station for the time that the shuttle is attached. And they have these gigantic science racks, and they transfer things from that into the station. And then they take science experiments that have to go back to Earth and put it into this Leonardo module. At the end of the mission, they'll take the robotic arm, disconnect it from the space station, and put it back into the cargo bay, and that flies back with the Discovery. So I thought I'd mention that early morning flight tomorrow. I'm going to drop one other topic. Last week I mentioned about the large Hadron Collider on Switzerland was going to be fired up on Tuesday, and it did. And from my budget, it went successful, and they'll be looking at that data for months and years to come. They'll be using this on a regular basis now for until the year 2013. Then they're going to up the power. Right now they're running at 3.6 trillion electron volts, and that'll become like 7 trillion a few years from now. And so they expect to get a lot of good science out of that. It did fire up on Tuesday successfully. So, good luck to that. Multi-billion dollar project. Back to you, Dick. WS1.
So they did get 3 and a fraction trillion electron volts, tera electron volts, I think it's called, TeV, and it's capable of going to 7 with those two colliding beams of protons and antiprotons, I believe, is what that machine uses. When it comes to the Discovery going to the International Space Station tomorrow morning, the first day of launch, let's hope that they make it, because I think the first day of launch is a lot safer than the second because of the ice buildup that can possibly happen on the foam of the external tank. When each docking of a shuttle occurs, some of the excess fuel left over on the space shuttle is used to boost the International Space Station into a slightly higher orbit. And that orbit is slowly decaying, and it has to be boosted periodically. From what you know, Paul, how do we stand on the altitude of International Space Station? Has it slowly been sinking because not as many docking missions have occurred? Or are we getting a little bit ahead of the curve, so to speak, getting it up to a nice high altitude that we can leave it alone for a while? Will the Progress ships or their replacement also be doing this boosting? So where do we stand on the boosting of the International Space Station? And has McCluskey of Maryland, that particular lady, started saying that we really should extend the space shuttle because we don't have a replacement for a long time to come? WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
No, I haven't heard her talk about anything ever since the Hubble. Well, you got to remember that she's from Maryland, and that's the state that's really involved with the Hubble control. But space shuttle missions, I don't see it going on beyond September 15th unless the missions are scrapped for one reason or another. So, there's some talk that there are people that would like to bring back the Constellation program in some form, but, there's a couple of people pushing for that. I'd like to see that, but I don't think so. Right now it seems to be really a dead issue. I just keep my fingers crossed because we won't really have a manned space program. I mean, even... was it yesterday? There was a docking of a Soyuz spacecraft, two Russians and an American, American woman. They become 3 new crew members to the space station. That occurred yesterday. Here we are going up with a show. None of these people are staying on board. They're all coming back. So, our resupplying of people and bringing them back in the future are only going to be done through the Soyuz spacecraft. And as far as the reboot goes, let me drop it. This is WS2N. This thing is like a million-pound thing,
But right from the beginning, when they sent up Daria and the living department of for the Russians, when that was sent up, Unity was the next part by the United States to dock with Daria, and then they sent up the Russian living module. You know, these two or three sections, the Zarya was, they called it a functional cargo block. I mean, this thing was loaded with batteries and loaded with fuel. I mean, it has rockets on board to boost itself up. So from the beginning, it had that capability to actually boost itself in any kind of a decaying orbit. The fuel that's been brought up by Progress ships over the years, we drop it. But now the thing is, the equivalent of, well, to give you an idea, it's like 10 rooms. Like in the early years you had Zarya and the Zesda spacecraft and Node, the Unity Node. They were the early pieces in 2001. Now here we are, 9 years later, and you've attached, your big rooms, from that you've just connected the, Destiny Lab, and then another node after that. You've got the Columbia module. It's another huge living quarters by European Space Agency. You've got the Kaibo facility, which is two gigantic living quarters by Japan. That's now attached to the space station. And these are only the rooms. You've got the Quest module. That's what they use for space walking. And it's really nothing but a room. In fact, they stay in there for the night before, depressurized, to save time when they do an EVA and, the next day. This is a massive thing, and this is only the living quarters. Let me drop it.
A2YO disconnected.
Let me see if I have it. Eric's not going to be happy. And that's only the living quarters. Then you've got this structure that they have. A half a dozen trusses going to the port side, a half a dozen trusses going to the other side. Each side has two gigantic solar panels, 240 feet by 40 feet. That would be one panel. You've got two on one side, two on the other that are like that. Gigantic radiators. This is a huge thing. In fact, you can go on the net and you can go for a virtual tour and, go through all the different modules. And it's really like a 10-room space station. So to boost this thing, you've got the Progress ships that go up. They'll put fuel on board. They'll actually boost the station. Of course, the space shuttle does it all the time, and they try to get it up about 14 miles each time. Soyuz craft, they don't really boost it because they use those craft to come back. And then there's they have the new ones going up by the European Space Agency called the ATVs, Automatic Transfer Vehicles. They'll attach themselves to the station, and they're bigger than the Progress ship, and they have the capability of boosting it. So they'll keep the law, for the next 10, 15 years, Dick. Back to you. WS2N.
Okay, one last question along those lines, Paul. If I made a graph of altitude of the International Space Station versus years, from your recollection, are we gaining, losing, or holding our own? In other words, with each one of the missions of a shuttle, some boosting takes place. Are we slowly getting ahead of the curve and boosting it to a higher altitude, or are we slowly losing a little bit? Over to you, Paul.
They keep that They keep the same number. You know, they're always within, you know, 10, 20 miles of where they started off. Of course, they don't want to go too high, and then you get into the radiation area. If you kept drifting it high, you know, that would be ideal. You know, let's push it. Keep pushing it. Push it up a bit. Make it 300, 400 miles, you know. But then they're getting closer to the Van Allen belts. They're happy where they are. I don't see a problem. I've never really read that there'll ever be a problem with that. But the higher you are, of course, there's less molecules around and less things to degrade your orbit. Every time you have a solar flare, the atmosphere expands, and when it expands, you have more molecules coming closer to the space station than everything else in low Earth orbit. So, you know, that's always a problem. It'd be nice to get it up another 100 miles. But, no, they leave it right where it is. It's good for the Progress missions and the Soyuz missions. You got to remember, you know, we're partners with the Russians on this and 15 other countries. And for them to start launching things to higher orbits, you're going to have less of a payload. Back to you, Dick.
One last question, Paul. They may not have told you, but maybe you've got a guess, or maybe they really said it. If for some reason absolutely no boosting took place to the International Space Station from now on, what's your guess as to its longevity? Would it remain in orbit for 8 years? Rough guess. Over to you, Paul.
Oh, I would think... Let's see, about 240 miles, I think it is. And every year, I think you would drop an average of 10 miles, I think it is. So you got to get down to the, 120 mile area before you're in trouble. Each time you go lower, that number changes. You know, let's say in 1 year it would be 10 mile drop. The next year might be, you know, 9 miles. 11. The other way, it might be 11 and then 12. You know, because you're running a bit more air molecules. So, I don't know how. I've never really heard about that, but I know every year, every time a shell goes up, it's usually 14. You know, they always say 14 miles up. So, my guess. Probably 5 to 10 years before they get in trouble. Probably 5 years.
When the shuttle does 14 miles worth of boosting of the International Space Station, what do you think they're doing? Using up 50% of their reserve fuel in order to get back to Earth?
Well, even the Soyuz. I mean, they really don't use much fuel from the Soyuz, but they will reboost it with the Soyuz. And of course the shuttle, and percentage-wise, whatever they need to get back, you know, they're just using their maneuvering jets. They're not turning on the ohms, the orbiting maneuvering system. There are two big rockets in the back of the shuttle. That only comes on for either a major orbital change or when they're coming back. That, you know, they'll face the shuttle in the opposite direction that they're going and fire the ohms rockets. Two big rockets in the back. I mean, they just use their thrust motors, so they need, you know, enough, whatever it is left. I don't know if it's 50% or not. Depends. I guess it depends on how much they use to get up there. You know, on how much fuel that they're going to dedicate to this. But it always seems like it's 14 miles, so whatever it is, I've never heard anything less. They never shoot for 20 miles. back to you, Dick.
And the OMS, OMS, Orbital Maneuvering System, those great big engines in the back, I'm going to guess they don't use those because that would be a little bit too violent a thrust for the total International Space Station. So I think you're telling me that the small thrusters, the reaction control system, is that what's used to do the boosting? And is there any coupling between the reaction control system fuel and the major fuel from the Ohms engine? Over to you, Paul.
Nah, they're different tanks. Completely different tanks. The 38 thrusters on the shuttle. Well, naturally, they're only going to use the ones that are facing in the right direction at the time, so they're all hydrazine rockets. And there's various sizes. They're all not the same output. They all have different thrust depending on where they're located on the orbiter. And the Ohms rockets, they're heavy duty. They're the ones that really slow the shuttle down to deorbit to come back to Earth. They really use them twice during the mission. You know, when they go up, you get your three main rockets going, and then they shut down. And then when they get to the other side of the Earth, 180 degrees around, then the Ohms rockets comes on. Otherwise, you'd have an elliptical orbit, and that changes it to a circular orbit. And that's why when you put the Ohms rockets on again, except in the opposite direction, you're slowing the shuttle down, and it will deorbit. And what you're really doing is creating an elliptical orbit that will actually crash into the Earth. That's what they're really doing when they fly those Ohms rockets. Back to you.
Okay, thank you. Good stuff. Do we know of any other major unmanned missions? I think, I believe it's called New Horizons, the one that's on the way out to Pluto. I think also the mission that's been flying by Mars is sometime in the next year going to go in orbit. Mercury is about to go in orbit around Mercury, the very first time we've ever done that. I think that particular craft has already done two flybys. So, to your knowledge, Paul, is there any update on any of the unmanned missions? Over to you, Paul, K2LIW.
Yeah, that's the Messenger mission. It's done, I think, one flyby, I thought. Maybe two. But eventually, by doing that, they're actually slowing it down. And eventually they'll put that into the orbit of Mercury. That's a nice mission. They have all kinds of insulation on one side, so it doesn't get heated up by the sun. But I think that's 2013. Kepler, that's going out to Pluto. That's not going to orbit Pluto. That will be a flyby of Pluto, so within a 3-hour span, they're going to get all the data that they could possibly get when that happens. That's 2015, and that was launched, what, 5-6 years ago, and it's not going to get there for another 5 years. The people that they picked for that, for the team on Earth, were all very young because they knew it was going to be like 10 or 12 years later by the time they got there. So it was interesting to see the an interview with those people who were very young. And like the guy said, well, I'll be 38 when it gets into orbit. I'll be 40 or something. So unbelievable. Let me drop it. I know the two Mars probes are doing good. Spirit and Opportunity. They're hanging in there. I don't know if Spirit ever got out of the ditch. I haven't heard anything about that lately. But they said even if it doesn't, it's going to do a lot of good science from right where it is. And there's no off button. It's not like they're going to send a signal from Earth and say, okay, we had enough with Spirit. Let's just shut it off. There is no off button. So it'll keep searching for Earth forever, as long as it has power from the sun, and looking to either do science or try to get out of the hole. So they're doing good. I don't know of any other unmanned flights coming up in the near future. Robotic flights. Next one I think is another year and a half away. I think would be